loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two major stories. First, we address President Trump's informal press conference held yesterday after the cabinet meeting. He discussed a timeline on a U.S. troop withdrawal from Syria, among many other topics. We're going to be joined by Ambassador Peter Ford, the former U.K. ambassador to Syria. And then we continue our weekly series. We have it every Thursday. It's called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, major technology companies came under heavy pressure on Wall Street today after Apple announced an unprecedented cut in its sales forecast, citing failing iPhone sales and pressure from the trade war with China. It was the first time in more than 15 years that Apple cut its earnings forecast. Shares of Samsung, Microsoft, Intel, and companies that make components for Apple also fell. And this might just be the tip of the iceberg as other companies brace for declining revenues. Next, the New York Times yesterday published an article saying that sexual harassment and sexual discrimination were serious problems in Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential campaign. The article noted that nearly a dozen former campaign staff members said that Sanders' failure to address the problem in 2016 could jeopardize a run for president in 2020. But is this New York Times attack on Sanders part of a larger effort to torpedo a 2020 bid before it gets started? Then it's time again for our regular weekly segment, Veterans for Peace, where we'll discuss contemporary issues of war and peace that affect veterans, their families, and the country as a whole. What's ahead for the peace movement in 2019? And then, in an historic first, a Chinese lunar rover successfully landed on the far side of the moon yesterday. Chinese scientists said the landing was a bullseye. The rover will conduct a number of experiments and will study the interaction between solar winds and the moon's surface. But the biggest impact of the landing may really be political. And finally, the government of the Democratic Republic of the Congo is anything but democratic. President Joseph Kabila, who has ruled with an iron fist, is stepping down after 17 years following mass protests demanding democracy and an end to the persecution of opposition activists. After repeatedly postponing elections, votes from opposition strongholds are just trickling in, and Kabila has shut down the country's internet, and observers are complaining of widespread electoral irregularities. And in other headlines, 16 states in the District of Columbia filed an appeal today challenging a federal judge's ruling that the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional. All states involved in the appeal are led by Democrats. Republicans have made opposition to the ACA a hallmark of their politics since the law's passage, but were unable to repeal the law over the past 2 years when the party controlled the presidency and both houses of Congress. In Saudi Arabia, a trial began today for 11 suspects accused of participating in the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The country's attorney general is seeking the death penalty for five of the subjects. Critics of the Saudi government, however, allege that the true mastermind of the killing was none other than the kingdom's de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The Venezuelan government defended itself yesterday, saying that Colombia and the United States' hostile activities toward the country were aimed at distracting from failed anti-drug policies. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met with conservative Colombian President Iván Duque yesterday in a tour widely believed to be aimed at fomenting regime change in Venezuela. Previously, he attended the inauguration of far-right Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro. Martin O'Malley, the former governor of Maryland and a candidate in the 2016 Democratic presidential primary, endorsed Beto O'Rourke for president in the 2020 contest. O'Rourke has not yet declared his intention to run, but caught the attention of many Democrats for running a closer-than-expected race against Texas Senator Ted Cruz. O'Malley's endorsement came in the form of an op-ed written for the Des Moines Register, influential in the crucial early caucus state of Iowa. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and clear.
Now we turn to the prospects of a U.S. withdrawal from Syria. President Trump held his first cabinet meeting of the new year yesterday after having his secretaries take turns gushing about his wonderful leadership. Trump cast doubt on his previously announced withdrawal plan from Syria, saying he had not announced a timetable Will the administration and the Pentagon slow walk the U.S. withdrawal? Will U.S. troops ever leave at all? We're joined from the U.K. by Ambassador Peter Ford. Peter Ford is the former U.K. ambassador to Syria. And we're joined in studio by Walter Smolarek. He is the Sputnik News analyst and producer of this show. Welcome to both of you.
Happy to be here.
Thank you.
Ambassador Ford, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too.
I'm sure the Syrian people are feeling better at the beginning of this new year than they were at the beginning of last new year, because it seems with each passing month, the possibility that this long, cruel, barbaric war that has so devastated their country, their people, their families, might be coming to an end. Donald Trump, when he said in a sort of startling way that he was prepared and not prepared, he was going to have American troops leave Syria, that must have been greeted as very, very good news in Syria. It wasn't greeted with such good news inside the Pentagon. James Mattis, Secretary of Defense, immediately resigned. He didn't cite Syria in his resignation letter, but the timing could not be coincidental. Anyway, when you heard Donald Trump yesterday, what was your take?
Frankly, I'm not that worried. This withdrawal is going to happen, whether it takes 30 days, 60 days, 120 days, or even 6 months. It's going to happen. The precise timing is no longer important. It's the direction of travel that counts. People can begin to make their calculations now. They are already, the Kurds are already in deep discussion with Damascus and with Moscow on the modalities for the return of the Kurdish regions to the bosom of the Syrian state. The Turks are holding off in the knowledge that eventually the U.S. will withdraw, that the U.S. protected Kurdish militia will betake themselves far away from the Turkish border, possibly even dissolve themselves completely. This is the way it's going to go. The die is cast. When someone like Elizabeth Warren can read the writing on the wall, it's game over.
Ambassador Ford, I want to play an audio clip from Donald Trump. He was talking at the cabinet meeting. He invited the media in. It was a fairly bizarre event. I think he had a picture of Donald Trump himself with a sort of Game of Thrones poster that was in front of him. Anyway,
the sanctions are coming.
It was odd. Anyway, let's listen to an audio clip.
And I'm the only person in the history of our country that could really decimate ISIS. Say we're bringing the troops back home over a period of time. I never said so quickly, but over a period of time. But everybody gives me credit for decimating ISIS. So we do that, and we say we're going to bring the troops back home where they belong. I've been campaigning on that for a long time before I won. A big part of my campaign, I want to bring our troops back from the endless wars. We have endless wars. They're going on for 19 years in the area.
So, yeah, I mean, Walter, Ambassador Ford says, and we know that people here are skeptical about whether U.S. troops are going to leave Syria, because a lot of times they never leave any place unless they've been driven out, like they were driven out of Vietnam. But, you know, it says, you know, Trump is saying two things here. He's saying, yeah, I'm bringing them troops home, but he doesn't say about how quickly. What do you think about Ambassador Ford's take? Is it going to happen?
Yeah, well, I certainly hope it's going to happen. I mean, the U.S. military presence there has been, I mean, nothing but a hindrance to sort of the, you know, peaceful resolution of the war in Syria. And I think it would be a tremendous step forward if they were to leave and finally respect Syrian sovereignty. The piece that makes me worried, though, and I think that's sort of reflected at least partially in what Donald Trump is saying, is the enormous power of the Pentagon over the U.S. government. I mean, that's truly far and away the dominant part of the U.S. government, not to say that that's the only part that matters. But, you know, I always think about, you know, the nationwide ceasefire that was negotiated, I believe, was in 2015 when Obama was still in office. And, you know, what did the Pentagon do? Well, they just bombed a Syrian army position, right? And, you know, they said it was an accident, but it was a sustained bombing. It was clearly done on purpose. And that was, you know, so much for the ceasefire. So, you know, I think there are machinations going on, or there could be a compromise, right, where, like, okay, maybe Syrian troops do, I mean, U.S. troops do leave Syria, but they just go, you know, a few miles across the border to Iraq and then, you know, prepare to reinvade the country at a moment's notice. So I think, you know, people who are in solidarity with Syria, who oppose U.S. wars around the world, need to pay very close attention to those details.
I'm wondering, Ambassador, too, what we should expect to see from the Turks. You know, the Turks have been relatively silent in the last week or so. They are watching the news just like everybody else is. They're watching Donald Trump make these idiotic statements where he goes back and forth. What do you expect the Turks to do, knowing now that the United States is not going to be out of Syria, let's say, tomorrow?
Well, what Turkey is not going to do is what all those Washington critics are saying it's going to do, that is, wade in and massacre the Kurds. Turkey is not that stupid. Even when all the U.S. forces have been withdrawn, it will not be in Turkey's interest to court a U.N. Security Council unanimous condemnation with sanctions and whatever, when Assad's going to do the job for them. The Kurdish militia are already in discussion with the Damascus government on disbanding, on dissolving themselves, removing themselves from the area close to Turkey. This is exactly what Erdogan wants. And in fact, he said this. People just don't listen. He has said this. There's no need for us to go in if the PYK, the Kurdish militia, are going to remove themselves.
What is it, Ambassador Ford, about Erdogan's position towards the Kurds? I mean, do you believe that Erdogan deep down believes that if there's any kind of autonomy or semi-autonomy or limited autonomy for the Kurds in any part of Syria, that that indeed will set off a chain of events or be a catalyst for a drive for Kurdish autonomy in Turkey, where a great many more Kurds actually live?
Yes, exactly. It would have repercussions in Turkey itself, and a Kurdish statelet in northern Syria would become a sanctuary and a launch pad for attacks on Turkey, or at least that's what the Turks are afraid. And I think most analysts think they're right to be somewhat afraid. But fortunately, it is not now going to happen. The only circumstance in which it could happen is if, paradoxically, the U.S. forces remain. It's under the umbrella of the U.S. forces that the Kurds have become too daring for their own good, have provoked the Turks into giving these ultimata. It's only if the U.S. Withdrawal becomes indefinitely long drawn out that Turkey is going to attack or hurt the Kurds. The Kurds' own best interest is served by the U.S. withdrawal. It was never going to be the case that the U.S. would stay in Syria forever and ever and ever.
Ambassador Ford, how many, if you know, how many Kurdish fighters are there approximately? And what, in terms of their, you said they've sort of overreached or overpresented in terms of their own influence, their own power. What is this, their military strength?
30,000 to 50,000 men, not all mobilized currently. But that includes reserves who could be mobilized. They're a very significant force, and they also have large amounts of weaponry that have been given to them by the U.S. But apparently, the U.S., the Pentagon, have decided that they're going to take their weaponry home with them. And this is the main reason why the withdrawal has to take so long. A Pentagon source was quoted as saying that to get the personnel out would only take 30 days. It's getting the heavy equipment out, which will take all the time. So it's so bizarre. It's so bizarre. On the one hand, the Pentagon says it doesn't want to leave the Kurds without protection. On the other, it says we're staying so long because it will take that time to get the equipment out.
At least.
Yeah. So let's think through the calculations here. If the Americans leave, as Trump says, we are leaving, we're pulling these 2,000 U.S. troops. I don't actually know the number of U.S. troops that are in Syria. But let's say they pull them out, and then the entire area is reoccupied by the Syrian Arab army. the Syrian government's army. Do you think that the Pentagon is concerned that that will appear, be perceived as a defeat for the U.S.? Is that part of the hesitation, or if there is hesitation on the part of the Pentagon?
Yes, it is. And this argument appears in all the pundit advice and recriminations that, hey, we're losing ground to Russia and Assad and Iran. We're leaving a vacuum, and they're going to extend their influence. It's all baloney. The Assad is now going to inherit these war-damaged areas. It's going to be a big problem to rebuild them. One thing the U.S. has not done during its overlordship of these areas is helping their stabilization by rebuilding infrastructure. If there's one thing that would encourage more instability in Syria, it's a huge economic crisis, and only ISIS could benefit from that. But yeah, the Pentagon, they always need a bogey, don't they? So they invent reasons why they can't withdraw, because the other guys would then step in. Well, it's the other guy's country, as it happens. It's not a province. It's not Kansas there. As Trump said, it's sand and death. There is no big U.S. interest in staying around. And with typical honesty, he said it's not like there was vast oil wealth, which is a way of admitting that we only hang around in the Middle East at all because we want the oil money. At least he's being honest, even poetic about this. Sand and death. I'd love this guy.
All right. Well, let's listen to that audio clip, the one you're referring to. We're speaking to Ambassador Peter Ford. Ambassador Ford was the UK's ambassador to Syria. We're also in studio with Walter Smolarek, Sputnik News analyst and producer. Let's hear Donald Trump again. This is him speaking again at the New Year's cabinet meeting about just this topic.
Syria was lost long ago. It was lost long ago. And besides that, I don't want, we're talking about sand and death. That's what we're talking about. We're not talking about, you know, vast wealth. We're talking about sand and death.
Walter, very straightforward. Sand and death, not wealth, meaning not oil.
Yeah, right. So I mean, the point that Ambassador Ford was making that, you know, this is a roundabout way of admitting that the United States goes into countries in the Middle East to pillage their resources. I mean, that should not be lost. I mean, and also on the sand and death, I mean, Syria is like a millennia old culture. I mean, there's a lot more there than, you know, sand and death. But all that aside, I think the argument among people in the U.S. military and foreign policy circles that want to stay there, I think what they're saying in a way to, I think they believe this, and as a way to appeal to Donald Trump, is that, well, if the United States leaves, then that opens a vacuum that the Iranians will fill, right? And anti-Iran aggression has been, you know, such a hallmark of the Trump administration's foreign policy that that's something that may resonate in a lot of corners, right? So, you know, they're arguing that because Iran is a longstanding ally of Syria, they've sent, you know, military advisors over there, as well as organize the training of various militias, that the, any reduction in U.S. influence will lead to some type of increase in Iranian influence. And so under the rubric of the regime change push against Iran, which is something that Donald Trump has fully and enthusiastically embraced, and his aides have even more fully and enthusiastically embraced, like Mike Pompeo or John Bolton or, you know, who knows who the next Secretary of Defense will be. People are saying that the next Secretary of Defense might be Tom Cotton, who is a well-known, perhaps the most well-known anti-Iran hawk in the Senate. So I wonder how much traction that narrative will be able to gain.
When Lindsey Graham, who condemned Trump for announcing the troop withdrawal, when he met with Trump, he said he feels better now because he was signifying that Trump isn't actually going to do it anytime soon.
Well, the withdrawal was a metaphor for not withdrawing.
But Ambassador Ford is saying, no, Trump is going to withdraw. So what is Trump telling? I mean, you have Rick Santorum, you have Lindsey Graham, these Republican hawks.
But the thing is when people challenge Trump, even members of his own party, he doubles down because he thinks he's the smartest guy in the room. He's smarter than you are. He's smarter than I am. Smarter than Lindsey Graham and Rick Santorum and all these others. And so the more people that tell him he's making a mistake, the more committed he is to carrying through on his original decision just to prove everybody else wrong. So I think the ambassador's right. I think that it may not be next week, but I think that the troops are going to come home.
Yeah. Lindsey Graham, apparently Ambassador Ford, doesn't think that. Or do you think that, I mean, it's one of two things. Either Trump is just playing everybody, which, hey, that would not be a big surprise. He could tell Lindsey Graham whatever he wants to tell him to get him to shut up. Or Trump is deciding, yes, my base wants us to leave, meaning, you know, he promised to leave Syria. I'm going to say we're leaving Syria, but I'm vague enough now that if the situation changes in any way, meaning the internal political situation in the U.S., we don't have to do it, not in months and maybe not in a couple of years. Again, I'm uncertain about where this goes. Go ahead.
Well, you know the U.S. political scene better than me, but I think that there's been an interesting sign of the times in the statement made by Elizabeth Warren saying that Trump is right on this withdrawal. Seems to me that the whole terms of the debate on never-ending war, as Trump himself calls it, are changing, and that Trump's sudden decision has galvanized something of a debate even in the U.S. I'm personally confident he will stick to his guns, and I point as a further piece of evidence to his inflammatory remark about Iran, where he said, look, Iran's pulling out of Syria. Iran can do whatever they want. This was baiting the Israel lobby.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
totally.
Indeed it was.
Totally.
Promptly taken the bait. This guy doubles down, as you said. He is not walking away or going to let himself medium term be talked out of this. It's a winner. It's a vote winner. And with the economy tanking, he's not going to want to be get blamed for never-ending war.
Walter Smolarek, go ahead.
I think there's some possibility that, I mean, the general sentiment among the population of the United States, I think, is generally, if not opposed to war, at least skeptical of war, because it's just been going on endlessly, especially. I mean, you know, there's certainly an argument that could be made that the U.S. has been permanently at war for most of its existence, but certainly since September 11th, the United States has been engaged in multiple, ongoing bombing campaigns, military occupations. I mean, people in, there are like tens of millions of people in the United States who, the entirety of their life, the United States has been occupying Afghanistan. So I think that will be a very real pressure. What happens to the economy, I agree, impacts that calculation. But then, again, it just has to run up against the institutional power of the Pentagon and the generals.
We're talking to Ambassador Peter Ford. He's the former UK ambassador to Syria. We're talking to him from London. We're talking in studio with Walter Smolarek, a Sputnik News analyst. I want to play another audio clip from Donald Trump's New Year cabinet meeting. Again, this time he's talking about the profound impact that he, as a leader in particular, and the United States in general, have had in the battle to defeat ISIS in Syria. Let's listen.
In many respects, it's very exciting because I like winning. When I took over Syria, Syria was a mess. It was riddled, I think you could say this better than anybody, it was riddled with ISIS. And now everybody says it's down to 1% of the land. And sometimes you could even say less. 1%. The place was a mess. It was terrible.
Ambassador Ford, Donald Trump is not going to win any eloquence awards. Do you agree?
I think that he's very clever, actually. He knows his base. He uses language that will resonate with his base. I think he's a lot cleverer than people give him credit. Maybe it's instinctive, it's not intellectual, but he is a magician with words and tweets.
What about the content that Syria was a mess until the American troops arrived? The land was riddled with ISIS, but now it's down to 1%.
Yeah, well, that is not strictly true, not even partially true. The first part of the statement, ISIS were already well on the way to being defeated, largely by the Russians, the Iranians, and the Syrians. When Trump came to power, it had lost most of its territory by that time. But he does deserve some credit for the final stages of the battle up there in the northeast. I don't really blame. He's a politician. We have to cut him a little slack for applauding himself because no one else is going to. And he's taken a brave and difficult decision, meeting a lot of opposition. He's zigzagging, twisting and turning, trying to avoid the flak. I think he's being quite clever, and he's outboxing and outfoxing all his opponents.
And another thing that I think we should think about when we're considering this question of who really defeated ISIS, when any U.S. politician, be it Donald Trump or anyone else, claims credit for the defeat or the virtual defeat of ISIS, you have to ask the question, well, where did ISIS come from in the first place? And, the United States invaded Iraq in 2003. There is no al-Qaeda there. There is no other, related political formations. The United States imposed a explicitly sectarian system of government on Iraq. They carried out a policy called de-Ba'athification, which alienated a huge part of the Sunni population, including people who are members of the security forces. That created a political vacuum out of which an organization called the Islamic State of Iraq could grow, which was the official al-Qaeda affiliate of Iraq. Once the war in Syria broke out, I think it was about 6 years after the Islamic State of Iraq was formed, they moved into Syria. They became the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. They launched a lightning offensive, throughout Syria and Iraq in 2014, split with al-Qaeda, declared themselves the Islamic State. And that's, the organization that we're talking about today. I mean, it's 100%, I think, an avoidable consequence of U.S. Aggression in the region.
Walter makes a good point there that however Trump is trying to leave, he's trumpeting that the Americans defeated ISIS, the American government. I mean, he's right, whether it was intended or unintended consequences, there was no ISIS before America's super aggressive and I would say criminal interventionist policy.
Yes, absolutely. The U.S., successive administrations, going back to Bush, played simultaneously the roles of arsonist and fireman with regard to ISIS. Absolutely. But better late than never. There is now a president who says that we've spent far too long in the Middle East, 19 years, whatever it is, and it's high time that we got out. I have to applaud that. Better late than never. And if he has to make some tactical maneuvers on the way out, well, we have to understand that.
Okay, that's Ambassador Peter Ford. Let's hear a quick final audio clip from Donald Trump at the cabinet meeting, and then Walter, you'll take us out. Go ahead.
We're spending all of this money. I want to spend money in our country. But we've had a tremendous success in Syria. We're slowly bringing people back and bringing them back, and we're hitting the hell out of them, the ISIS people.
Walter, Ambassador Ford, I think, is really correct. Trump feels that this is a winning political argument with people in the United States, because guess what? Whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, especially if you're in working class communities, if anybody's kids are going to be sent to the war zone, it's probably going to be your kids, not the kids of rich people.
Yeah, absolutely. And simultaneously, while rich people are living very, very, very comfortably, you see your communities having, good union paying jobs, hollowed out, social services cut, infrastructure decay. The thing I would add to Donald Trump's statement is that in addition to spending that money here in the United States, I think some of it should go to the victims of U.S. foreign policy, too.
All right. That was Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News analyst. And we were joined from the UK, from London, by Ambassador Peter Ford. Ambassador Ford is the former UK ambassador to Syria. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida, by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Welcome back, guys.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
We normally circulate a list of articles that we want to talk about, and actually the list today is very, very strong. I want to touch on one thing first. Paul, I've been going through the latest copies of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines, and I noticed a pattern. It's something that you touch on in both of the magazines, and it's that fewer and fewer states are sentencing people to death. In fact, in several southern states, with North Carolina being the most interesting example, they've gone two consecutive years now without sentencing anybody to death. And in the last 4 years, they've only sentenced one person to death. This seems to be a trend. And I was looking for a reason, thinking, assuming that it was because lethal injection drugs are getting harder and harder to get. But that's not really it. It's a combination of things. Certainly that's a factor. But it's also in part because it's so much more expensive to sentence somebody to death and to keep them and maintain them on death row. But it's also that politics in America are changing. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, I don't think it's so much the politics or the expense. I mean, the government has shown that they're willing to spend billions of dollars if necessary to murder American citizens. They're ready to fight to the last payer of taxpayer money to kill all of us. But rather, I think some of the seminal changes that I think that's happened is juries have grown increasingly skeptical of the death penalty. There's been steady drumbeat of exonerations of people that are factually innocent that have been cleared off of death row year after year. I don't think a month goes by that there isn't a headline about someone who's spent ridiculous amounts of time on prison or on death row that's factually innocent. And I think, that's had, an effect. I think the other thing that have had an effect too is a lot of states, they've enacted life without parole as an alternative to the death penalty, and that's one of the things I don't agree with, just because I think that death by incarceration isn't necessarily a very palatable alternative, but that's me. But I think that the combination of factors, though, I think the rise of life without parole as an alternative sentence, as well as the overall, I think, discrediting of the death penalty that we've seen nationally. And it's been going on for several decades now. Year after year, there's the steady drumbeat of exonerations that have been going on. I think that most Americans, at least the ones that are serving on juries, rightly see this as kind of a bigger structural problem, even if prosecutors and politicians and the people in power in this country don't, but jurors are seeing this as raising serious questions that if they're going to kill someone, maybe they need more evidence. Maybe they need more in the way of testimony that doesn't come from jailhouse snitches. And I think that's been those are some of the factors that I think that's diminishing the appeal of the death penalty. Unfortunately, our politicians and our political class is lagging behind on this.
I think that's right. I noted also in the magazine that Washington State Supreme Court just declared the death penalty there unconstitutional. There are moratoria on the death penalty in other states for the very reasons that you cite. And that, maybe we're going to have to seek a judicial change in this policy rather than a legislative one if Congress continues to prove that it's just not willing to take up the issue.
Well, it's interesting because the number of state legislatures have actually banned or eliminated the death penalty. And so on the one hand, we've seen that happen. Then on the other hand, at the federal level, our Congress, we under Bill Clinton, we had a massive expansion of the death penalty. Federal death row has received a lot of criticism because of racial bias in the application of the federal death penalty. I think last time we reported on it, I think like 93 or 94% of the prisoners on federal death row are black or Hispanic. So, the federal death penalty has a lot of problems. Unfortunately, I think Congress lacks the will even more than the state legislatures to do anything about the federal death penalty. And in fact, it's one of those things, too, that I think it's worth noting that even as we have more and more exonerations, even as we have more people being proven to be factually innocent of the charges that landed them on death row, 22 years ago, in 1996, Congress passed and Bill Clinton signed into the law the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, whose purpose was to preclude the federal courts in particular from reviewing claims of innocence and claims by state prisoners and federal prisoners that are in court that are factually innocent. And that's been one of those things that's just been pushed you know, almost incessantly from by our Congress. And unfortunately, there's been no, you know, there's been no interest or no push in Congress, either in the House or in the Senate, to either revisit ADIPA or to, you know, reinstate the power of federal judges to review these convictions, wrongful or not. And I don't know if you remember, but, you know, the reason they gave for passing this law was the Oklahoma City bombing, and the purported fear or concern was going to be that Timothy McVeigh, who was convicted of the bombing, would somehow exercise his legal right to appeal his conviction and would somehow thwart the death chamber by doing that, which ultimately, of course, he wound up waiving all of his appeals and being executed without having exhausted his appellate process.
You know what? Let's change topics. There was a piece that Brian pointed out to me that was fascinating, and it's on our list. It's from the Washington Post. It's about a Maryland police officer, decorated commander, big hero in the police force, but the poor guy got himself addicted to heroin and devolved to the point where he was actually stealing heroin from the evidence room to keep up his habit. Now, he was not treated like any other thief stealing heroin. He got special treatment. Kevin, take us into that one.
Well, yeah, I think this is just a standard that we see in police departments of not being willing to hold officers who are part of these departments, part of their own departments, accountable. I mean, you'll find that usually the worst kinds of impacts or effects to officers when they're accused of irresponsible conduct, you know, that actually comes as forms of retaliation. So the officers that are looking out for people who are abusing drugs, who are raiding evidence rooms and shouldn't be, those are the officers who get punished. But the people like this officer that we're talking about who got hooked on drugs basically and became an addict, you know, this person is someone who doesn't receive much of any accountability. And that is about a standard when we look at police departments. And it would seem that this is actually not unusual, that there are actually departments across the country where we've seen the opioid crisis is affecting officers and that they're taking advantage of drug evidence that has been seized. I think there's a list of examples in this Washington Post article. We've got a trooper in Iowa. We've got a sergeant in Arkansas. We've got a detective in Kentucky. There are police chiefs in upstate New York and rural Ohio. So any place where the opioid crisis is rearing its ugly head, you've seen officers who have turned into addicts taking advantage of the stashes that they have. What's really abominable about this, though, as you're hinting at here, is that there are people on the other end. You know, there are the minorities, there are Blacks, Latinos, others who are going to be arrested for having these narcotic painkillers or for having drug stashes, et cetera, for dealing in drugs. And they're not going to get the kind of leniency. They're not going to get treated as people who are abusing drugs. They're going to be treated as criminals and be met with fierce prosecution.
Yeah, this officer or Lieutenant Dan Gosnell, he was stealing from the evidence vault because he was, according to the Washington Post story, addicted to drugs. The vault contains, here's from the article, years worth of drugs, pills, heroin, fentanyl, marijuana, cocaine, all heat sealed in plastic packs labeled and filed on medical shelves. Police store the drugs in case of legal appeals. They never had a reason for security cameras. Over the next months, Lieutenant Gosnell perfected his methods. He cut the seal with a razor blade, pocketed the painkillers, and dropped in decoy pills. Then he resealed and returned the pack. He started with the oldest cases. No one would ever know, he told himself. When he found no more old cases, Gosnell shut his office door and locked it. On his desk, he set another pack of drug evidence. Like addicts everywhere, he was a small, inevitable stop from pills to dope. Gosnell then tapped out the heroin powder. Now, what's important about this story is it's written with complete human compassion towards the officer. We're sympathetic to him. We learn about his earlier history, when he wasn't an addict, when he was doing good deeds, when he rescued people. And we learn as a consequence of this fact that he's fallen. He's a fallen person, that he was able to regain his life. and the judge gave him 200 hours of community service. Now, that would be all well and good if this was applied across the board, because everybody who's in prison or jail because of drugs or because of stealing so that they could get drugs or get money to buy drugs, if everyone was treated as a human being with a compassionate story, with a sort of a sense of sensitivity about their story, that would be good. But instead, Paul Wright, all the other people who are not cops are actually just demonized. And there's none of these compassionate type stories in the Washington Post. When I read this story, it made me sick, actually, because of the double standard, because of the hypocrisy.
Well, I think that that's one of the things that we see is that, you know, when people talk about the war on drugs, I also thought that's kind of a misnomer, because it's a war on poor drug users. And, you know, I think that's when you start looking for, you know, you look in vain if you're looking for rich people that have been convicted or imprisoned for, you know, for drug possession or even drug use. I mean, indeed, it seems to be endemic in the world of, you know, entertainment, business, and plenty of other places. And it's an ongoing thing in law enforcement. I think, I don't know if folks are, how many of your listeners are old enough to remember the Rampart scandal in Los Angeles, which turned out that the LAPD was falsely arresting young men they accused of being gang members and charging them with crimes they were factually innocent of. And that whole thing unraveled when a cop named Perez was caught breaking into the evidence room to steal cocaine to feed his drug habit. And when he was caught, he promptly ratted out all of his buddies that were framing innocent people. And it turned into this huge, you know, scandal. But it all stemmed from his drug addiction and stealing from the evidence room. And I think that, you know, cops have been stealing drugs from evidence rooms as long as there's been evidence rooms. And, you know, but again, it's this whole system, I think this whole system of impunity that, you know, that allows that to happen. And, you know, and again, I think, as you point out, it's just the thing, too, of, you know, how are drug addicts being treated? And, you know, are they being humanized? Are they being viewed as someone that have a public health problem that needs to be medically treated versus a carceral and public safety problem where they need to be prosecuted and caged. But, you know, we also see this a lot, I think, in terms of just how many of the victims of drug addiction now, to the extent that many of them are white, they're middle class, you know, there's very different coverage when drug addicts are white and middle class, or heaven forbid, white and wealthy, than when the victims of drug addiction are poor and black or poor and Hispanic, for example.
Yeah. Kevin Gastella, let's turn to another story. It's about Chicago, where you are. I'm looking at the Chicago Tribune website, how solitary confinement drove a young inmate to the brink of insanity. Then there's a picture of this man walking out of his door. He's now released. Anthony Gay, 44, speaks about his two decades in solitary confinement in Illinois prisons. And here's the first couple of sentences, and then I'll ask you to comment. With his mental state deteriorating as he sat in the crushing isolation of solitary confinement, a desperate inmate named Anthony Gay saw a temporary way out. Sometimes it came in the form of a contraband razor blade. Occasionally it was a staple from a legal document or a small shard of something he had broken. He would mutilate himself in his Illinois prison cell, slicing open his neck, forearms, legs, and genitals hundreds of times over 2 decades in solitary confinement. Once he packed a fan motor inside a gaping leg wound. Another time he cut open his scrotum and inserted a zipper. Each time he harmed himself, he knew that at least for a little while, the extreme step would bring contact with other human beings. God, go ahead.
Well, that's about as graphic as it can get. In fact, it reminds me of some of the vivid testimony that's been shared from Craig Haney, who is this person who has done a lot of work on the way that people mentally and physically deteriorate when they're in solitary confinement, and the sort of self-mutilation as well as the kind of insanity that takes over a person when they're forced into living in these conditions for not just years, but sometimes decades And it becomes so grotesque. I mean, the sort of, this is kind of an extreme, but I would probably guess that he's not the only person who has gone to these great lengths to get attention, because, you know, what he's describing is that if he did this, he would have somebody come from medical who would help him. And having that interaction with someone, a nurse, a doctor, someone who was trying to repair his body, even if it was wholly inadequate and wouldn't even heal certain wounds, or and the scars aren't going to go away, and it's not going to fix his psychological condition. But at least that interaction with that nurse, it was like taking a hit off of a joint or something for him, because he's getting this emotional high that he has no access to when he's confined in this cell. I mean, it's very devastating to read the description from Anthony here. And I think another thing that is important to understand about the system in which he's confined is that people who are confined in this way may not actually get to have face-to-face interactions without opening their cell door if they're in solitary confinement. In many instances in Illinois and other states, but I know about Illinois, the nurse is coming to the door and opening the flap and talking to you about your medical condition through the door. And so you're actually not really having a face-to-face interaction. So just someone coming in to check in on you if you're complaining about something, you know, this was his way to actually get somebody to treat him and to have a meaningful interaction with people, because he was held in isolation.
I want to add something to that too. In maximum security prisons, you don't even have human contact when you receive mail. What they have in most prisons is a small TV screen that's out of your reach, that's, you know, behind plexiglass, so you can't touch it or damage it. And if you receive mail, they'll put it on a scanner and scan it, and then you get to read it on the screen, and then it disappears. So you don't even get to go to mail call or have somebody physically hand you a letter or anything. You get to look at it, and then it goes away forever, and that's it. And people don't realize, too, that solitary confinement really does mean solitary, to the point where the United Nations has declared the use of solitary confinement in the United States as a form of torture. They've been crystal clear about that. People go insane. I was telling my own kids, I took them to Eastern State Penitentiary, which was the very first penitentiary in the United States. It's in the center of Philadelphia, and it's a tourist site now. It's a like a museum, and it's run down. Half of it's just in ruins. It's in rubble. You can take a guided tour through the prison. This is where solitary confinement was invented. So they would put you in a stone cube about 6 feet by 8 feet. All you had was a bed, a chair, a table, and a Bible. With the idea being, and this was 1837, the place was open until the early 1970s. The idea being, if you have nothing whatsoever to do but read the Bible, you're going to be reformed.
Of course you would be.
Well, instead, all it did is it made everybody insane. And if there was one thing we learned from the Eastern State Penitentiary, it's that solitary confinement simply does not work. It just makes people insane. Just 2 years ago, the New York Times Magazine, 2.5 years ago in May of 2016, New York Times Magazine had a very long story on the use of solitary confinement in the federal prison system. One of the prisoners that they highlighted there was in solitary confinement so long that he lost his mind. And the only way he could think to get attention, to have some kind of human contact, was to eat glass. And that's what he did. Well, he ate the glass, and medical was called, and the doctor refused to see him because he said, oh, he's not crazy. He just wants attention. Well, in fact, he was crazy because of the solitary, and he ended up shredding his stomach and nearly killing himself, which was probably the idea in the first place.
Paul Wright, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say is that, you know, when you go back to the Eastern State Penitentiary, Charles Dickens and Alexis de Tocqueville, both, you know, hundreds of years ago in the early 1800s when they toured America, they both wrote about these phenomenons, about the American fascination with solitary confinement, the fact that it drove people insane and destroyed people. And I think that in some respects, when we've seen the modern rise of American solitary confinement, and I think, you know, yes, it's been rightly condemned as a human rights violation, but I think, you know, we need to look at the scale of it on any given day. And statistics are kind of hard to come by, but the extent that people have looked at it, 80 to 100,000 prisoners on any given day are being held in solitary confinement for anywhere from a few days to years and even decades on end in this country. And that's one of the things that is an outlier of the United States. No one else does this. You know, no other country in the world is sticking people in solitary confinement for years and decades on end, year after year after year. And the United States does that. And I think that what people overlook is the real purpose of the American prison system is to destroy people. It's not to rehabilitate anyone. It's not to give anyone job skills. It's not to make them better. It's to destroy people. And unfortunately, they're pretty good at it. You know, and we've been doing this for a long time. And I think that to an extent that the lack of laws in this country is one of the things that also doesn't get talked about very much. We have a plethora of criminal laws, of laws to cage people, to lock them up, to do terrible things to them. But yeah, we don't have any laws that do things like ban torture. We don't have laws that even define how much space a prisoner is entitled to, whereas we have laws that, you know, how much space a primate is entitled to, or how much a raccoon is entitled to, but not people in prison. And when we lock people up, there's this literally they're stripped of so many rights. And one of the things that we've seen over the years is that as corporal punishment, physical beatings and floggings, which were commonplace in American prisons up until they ended as a result of court orders, largely by the mid-70s, as the physical abuse and the physical torture ended, it got replaced with more and more solitary confinement and these forms of psychiatric torture, which is aka solitary confinement, which is almost reverting back to 200-year history of driving people insane through isolation. And unfortunately, it's very widespread, and there's really nothing in the way of laws preventing this, either at the federal level or at the state level.
That's the voice of Paul Wright. We're talking to Paul Wright and Kevin Gastella, as we do every Thursday in this segment of Loud and Clear called Criminal Injustice, where we look at the most egregious conduct of the courts, the cops, the police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. Gosh, you know, when I hear Paul Wright say those numbers, 80 to 100,000 people on any given day, or maybe every given day in the United States are in solitary confinement. I wish we could open this show as this is Loud and Clear. We're going to talk about criminal injustice. We're talking from a studio in Washington, D.C., the capital of the United States, where 80 to 100,000 people are held today in solitary confinement. I wish we started, and maybe we should start every show with that moniker, because I think people don't know about it. They don't think about it. The media certainly doesn't present it. Kevin Gastella, going back to the Anthony Gay case, and then you can take it wherever you want to. I just want to bring up a couple other facts, again, from the Chicago Tribune article. Gay entered the Illinois Department of Corrections in 1994 as a young man convicted of robbery after brawling with another teenager who told police that Gay took his hat and stole a single dollar bill. He expected to serve as little as 3.5 years. That's not that little. Instead, a fight with a fellow inmate led to Gay's first stint in segregation, pushing him into a downward spiral that resulted in 22 years in solitary confinement. Shortly after the segregation started, the cutting and suicide attempts began. He was in jail for having a fight as a teenager and having been accused of stealing somebody's hat and $1. Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, so right there, we're hitting something that we've talked about over and over again, which is the need for reforms in sentencing laws. I mean, there's no reason why someone should have been in prison for the extensive time that, you know, Anthony was in prison for. And then you look at the fact that in solitary confinement, your mental condition starts to deteriorate very rapidly. And we know, regardless of whether the people in solitary confinement were mentally ill before or now they're mentally ill because they're in solitary confinement, we know that there are increasing numbers, or there's a high percent of people who are held in there who are mentally ill. And that's the way that prisons are handling those individuals. It's a way of managing their mental illness. You know, you have judges recognizing that in Illinois, there are 1,100 prisoners in solitary confinement, and more than 900 of them have been diagnosed with mental illness. And so that's a high percentage. That's like, I think we're looking at 80 to 90% of those people who are in the solitary confinement in the state of Illinois are mentally ill people. And they're in there probably because that's how the warden or how the correction officials have decided to handle them. And I also wanted to bring up something about the Supreme Court, just because last year there was actually an opportunity for the court to hear a case on solitary confinement, and the court turned it down. And they said basically that the arguments around it weren't developed enough for them to look at the case yet. And I can't really speak to whether that was true or not. But Sonia Sotomayor did say very plainly that a punishment should not have to leave physical scars in order to be considered cruel and unusual. And she likened what was going on. She actually brought it back to Charles Dickens and said basically that what we're looking at, you know, came perilously close to a penal tomb. She was describing the conditions of solitary confinement to a penal tomb. So basically the death sentence is being put into solitary confinement. I think that's very important for people to understand, because even if these prisoners were not given the death penalty, even if they're not put in a sentence where they could be executed, the very fact that they're put into this condition of solitary confinement can be a death sentence on its own.
We've got only 45 seconds left. Paul, why don't you take us out with your final thoughts?
Yes, yeah, so I was going to say that, you know, that I think the problem with solitary confinement is that basically it's a form of torture, and to the extent that it's not recognized as such, I think merely perpetuates it. And unfortunately, no one in our political class has shown any interest or inclination whatsoever to stop, much less limit, torture in American prisons, and whether it's solitary beatings, tasers, pepper spray, whatever. So basically, here we are in the torture states of America.
Yeah, we are. Well, we were joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. Kevin's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we were joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. Paul is also the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.